incredible sound of classic rock. No, good, because now it's time for Visiting the Village.
Are you there, dude?
Hello, ladies and indeed gentlemen, and welcome to this glorious episode 55 of Visiting the Village, the gaming podcast that likes to deal with some of the more obscure news outlets and news items that we see in our gaming week. Joining me, as ever, is the incontrovertible Ian Hardingham.
Hello, I'm Ian Hardingham, and I spoke too soon.
Today's top story is Greg Zaschuk and Ray Musica leaving BioWare, the original founders. They're both going on to do very different things. Let me read for you their statements about what they're going to do. So first up, we have Ray Musica, and he says, "I feel the need now to move on to a new chapter in my career. With the growth of BioWare to multiple locations as part of a public company, following two decades of multiple successful product launches across many platforms and business models, I've largely personally achieved what I wanted to in video games. I now desire to take on a brand new entrepreneurial challenge." And now Greg Zaschuk. "The main project I will be working on is a web-based interview show called The Beer Diaries, where I interview notable brewers and showcase their beers." Ian Hardingham, what do you think about leaving the games industry?
Yeah, I mean, I think this sounds like a fairly standard exit. They've been running a pretty successful company for a really long time. It's now probably pretty unwieldy from their perspective. They probably don't do all that much anymore. And they've almost certainly got enough money to retire and not have to worry about money. So it basically becomes, this is retirement, you know. Yeah. They're focusing a lot on what they're going to do afterwards. But this looks to me like they're just going to sort of dabble in a few things, entrepreneurial stuff. And this certainly sounds like retirement to me. And that seems fair enough. I mean, you know, you start off and you've got 10 people or whatever, and you're massively involved and you're wearing all the different hats. And now there are hundreds and hundreds of people working for you. You've just released an MMO that has the Star Wars license and all that kind of thing. I understand it.
It seems to me like this is a good point for them to go. I mean, like they say in their statements, they've created this giant company that's now changed into something that's, you know, unimaginable to them when they started. And they have so many issues and difficulties to cope with now, especially things like, you know, their relationship with their community, dealing with this vast number of multiple huge products at once. That, yeah, if you want to go and make a web show about beer, or you want to go and save the world through entrepreneurial ventures, this is probably the time to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends a lot on sort of why you get into the business. So I've got into video games because I like making video games and designing them. And I don't know if my hunger for that will ever sort of go away. Like, I imagine if I was ever lucky enough to be in this position, I'm sure I won't be, that I might leave BioWare and then just start another small games company. You know, that's probably what would be attracted to me. Until I was actually ready to retire, maybe take a year off or something.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know where these guys come from, whether there's a lot of business background. And again, I'm afraid I don't know how much they've been involved in the design and stuff recently. But, you know, they're probably tired by the whole Star Wars thing. I mean, that they've had so many weird public relations stuff in the last couple of years. They probably just started getting a bit of sour taste in the mouth. It's probably not great for BioWare going forward, depending on how important they were as at the top of the company. You know, maybe it's completely fine. Maybe they'll sort of lose their way and get a bit too commercial. I don't know.
Yeah, it's really interesting, that distinction between people who start companies because they want to make things and people who start companies because they want to grow a big company. And those two things seem to be mutually exclusive. I think it's pretty difficult to have a company that scales up to a huge size and then to keep that connected with the products you're actually making, which is something that a lot of people don't really understand. I think people tend to expect business owners to want to scale their businesses up to this massive size and then leave. And I think there's probably a bit of both going on here. I think, you know, they could have made this exit a really long time ago with the size of the company if they were looking to, you know, just make a big company and cash out. So I think it's when the sentimental or emotional side of things and the commercial side of things get tied together, you get things like this, a late exit with these altruistic goals.
Yeah, I think maybe the key is, you know, as you get larger and larger, you hire people to do all the jobs that you find difficult, and then as you keep on doing that, you end up with nothing, you know, almost nothing left, and certainly nothing that sort of really ties you to the company and makes you feel like you're really involved in every product. So I think that's important. Yeah, I don't know what I'd do after if I was in that position. I'm sure I wouldn't make a web-based interview show called The Beer Diaries.
I don't know,
I'd
man.
be too busy drinking beer to make an interview-based web series about it.
Think that's the idea, though. I think he just wants to get the free beer, like the review samples. He's going to be a beer journalist. Is that not the
Do you
best?
get review samples? I don't
I
know.
think
That
that's how
sounds
it
like a good
works.
thing.
Yeah, I think because he says at the end, oh, if it doesn't go well, at least I will have got to have tasted some nice beer. Like the failure point of that is so strong. Yeah,
That's true,
so.
actually. He's got a much better, that's much better than video games. If you fail at video games, what have you got to show for it?
Exactly. I can imagine you doing something like that. Now on to the Xbox game, which gives you an odd gamer score for starting it and only reverts you back to even when you complete it. This is Double Dragon Neon. Ian Hardingham, what are we to make of this?
This is great. Wow. This is like the ultimate version of trolling. This is like the opposite of games that are really bad that try and sell themselves by having a really easy to accomplish gamer score, which apparently is something games actually do, sort of to force sales through Blockbuster and renting, etc., so that people just buy them to quickly go through them and get all, I don't know how much gamer score you get per game, 1,000 or whatever it is. This is great. You start it and it adds one to your gamer scores, and I believe this is the first time that a game has ever given an odd achievement
Yep.
and really trolls you right there and then and says you've got to finish this, otherwise you're going to have an odd gamer score for life. I think this is just the best thing ever. There's some really, really angry people on Xbox360achievements.org as well,
Yes,
and
there are.
I think that your life's worth should be measured by how many people you've managed to anger on websites like Xbox360achievements.org.
Well, that's a very good and noble metric. I mean, we've definitely messed around with things like Steam achievements before, but it's a whole new level. The fact that they know that people care whether you have an even
Exactly.
gamer score just shows how plugged in they are to this. And then they want to do the most offensive thing possible and swap that out. It's just like, I don't know. There are people out there who really, really care about this. I want to meet the people who are going to have to complete the game now. They install it and
Yeah.
it's like, well, this is it. Like, I hate these people. Look at
You
what they've
don't want to
done.
meet them because they're too angry, but I would have
Yeah.
gone further than this. I would have said you had to buy the sequel.
Right. Yeah,
You know,
why
if you
not?
wanted to make it even, you know, something even worse than that.
What was that game which I'm sure we've mentioned before that had you flying around your own hard drive and then it was posited that it could hold your files hostage until you
Yeah.
completed the game? Or maybe that's two different things. I think we elided those two things before, but
It
it's,
got flagged as
yeah,
a
as
virus
a
by
virus.
Norton.
Right, well, exactly. I mean, that's fair enough. I don't know. I think I want to see more of this. I want to see more meta usage of these systems for exploiting people's anger.
We haven't got as far as we can get with achievement trolling, definitely.
That there's a vast mine to be mined. On to failure now. Two items about failure, and the first of our failure items is about free-to-play failure. Hookshot Inc. has an interview with two-man indie team Mick and Greg, creators of Solipsgear, about their free-to-play failure Gasketball. Try saying that three times quickly. There was a lot of panic immediately after launch when we realized that we were doing pretty terrible sales numbers, and it probably wasn't going to improve without more work, said the game's designer Mike Boxleiter. Ian Hardingham, is free-to-play still viewed as a magic bullet?
I think it is still viewed as that, and that's the reason I wanted to talk about this. I think we don't hear anything like enough about the failures of FTP, and I'm really surprised. It would seem like something people would like to read about because a lot of people feel vast schadenfreude towards FTP. They really don't like it. And there must be an awful lot of failures. I don't believe that every single game released on FTP, minus Gasketball or Gasketball, whatever, is a success. These guys had a surprise hit with their first game, Solipsgear or whatever it is called, and for the sequel they decided to completely change the monetization strategy, going from pay once to free to play. It seems like a massively stupid idea to me. I think if you've just done really well with a pay once title, I think you should continue to do pay once titles. So that's my call really. But I do want to hear a lot more about this stuff. Like FTP, everyone in their hats is just saying it's the best thing ever, and I don't believe that it's the only answer.
Yeah, this is really interesting as well, because it's not like this was an unknown game. It had 600,000 downloads, which is really pretty good. But the fact was that it just didn't monetize well. And this is something that the free-to-play proponents, the serious free-to-play proponents, will talk about a lot. The idea of, yes, you can have a game that is popular that people play, but it can monetize poorly if you do the wrong things. And I think there are a few indications in this article, like, for example, the fact that they said, you know, it didn't launch with any analytics. So as soon as it didn't, you know, items didn't start selling well, they put analytics in. Like, that, you know, reflects a really naive approach to doing this in its entirety. But you're right, people don't talk about these failures enough, and they don't go into enough detail to let other people know what are the pros and cons of the business model.
I mean, I think it just sounds like the game isn't good enough. We didn't get data on how much people were playing, how long they're playing for, and 600,000 downloads for an iOS title isn't particularly impressive. It just sounds to me, a lot to me, like it's not a very good game. And the problem is that they kind of threw away all of the advantage they had from having their previous successful game, because a lot of people who I'm sure would have paid once for their sequel or the follow-up didn't have to.
Yeah.
So this is the kind of risk you're taking.
It's true. It's definitely a risk. Changing to something that you have no experience with is always a risk, certainly. It's just, I'm always, there's a big tendency for people who are anti-free-to-play to look at things like this and go, obviously, it doesn't work. And that's true. It's just, the problem is that there's no sensible way of looking at this. We've certainly seen in the last 2 years much more data coming out, much more, you know, do's and don'ts of how to do free-to-play coming out. So we just need a balanced argument which isn't based around isolated examples.
Yeah, but my position on this has always been that FTP works for a smaller subset of games than pay once. So if you have a really good game that people will play for quite a long period of time, then that can be an F2P success.
Yeah.
And there are lots of games that you can really enjoy for a few hours that just don't go for FTP. And I think that's why it's so risky. I don't think it's to do with not having had any experience with it. It's just that if you find a successful business strategy, I think it's a good idea to continue using that one.
Yeah, absolutely. And part of the naivety, I would say, is not understanding that. I mean, and also we don't know that about this game. It might be something that people are playing a lot, but it just monetizes badly. We don't know
that.
Yeah, that
would be almost more interesting if that were true.
Absolutely.
Maybe there is some, like, some aspect of the game itself that's good but unmonetizable. But I still think it's pretty simple. I think it's just, if you get people to play for a longer period of time, they'll pay money. But maybe there, you know, there probably are more subtleties to that. That's why we need better reporting on it.
Well,
I mean,
there's nobody who will argue against that. Like, it's integral to the entire free-to-play proposition that people are playing for a long time. They want to continue playing. In fact, Nicholas Lovell published an article today about why free-to-play games should always be free-to-play. They shouldn't stop you playing for an arbitrary reason, because that's poor monetization, because you want to keep people playing for a long time.
I guess, I mean, maybe that's not true in all cases. I mean, at some point, the best thing may be to charge someone and lose some users. I mean, again, that kind of statement, I think, leads to people altering the design of their games. You and me have talked a lot about how to make single-player linear experiences F2P, and I think that sort of the most far-ranging version so far is to have sort of certain pay barriers, basically almost a bit like the end of a demo, but a little bit more complicated. Mm. When you start saying you can never stop people playing, I think that pushes you into some corners design-wise.
Absolutely. Well, it's all about the corners design-wise. More failure now. This time, Kickstarter. Gamasutra has an article which goes into some of the reasons behind various Kickstarter failures, including the amazingly named Bad Dudes 2. More than half of Kickstarter campaigns fail to reach their funding goals. Do you think we'll see a change in how people consider Kickstarter now that the honeymoon period is over?
Yeah, I still feel like we're actually in the honeymoon period, but possibly like the end of the 2 weeks where it's still kind of like fun and you're still on holiday, but you're starting to feel like going home, that kind of thing. That's where I think we are at right now. Basically, people are still putting an awful lot of faith and money into Kickstarter projects. People are also aware that it can be bad to do it at the wrong time. Sort of, do you only get one chance? Like, is it embarrassing when you fail at $100,000 and go back in for $20,000? All those different things. There was some sort of semi-interesting stuff in this article. They were just saying you have to have a really good video. You have to spend a lot of time interacting with your community and stuff. The main problem that I have as a developer with using Kickstarter is as you have a success with it, people tend to go over the top with their stretch goals and sort of get themselves into real trouble. They start promising things that they can't deliver, or takes them, you know, 25% of the development time to deliver when it's not actually helping make the game good. I think it's definitely not clear yet the real negatives that Kickstarter can have on a development team.
Absolutely. I think this backs up some things I've thought as well, which is that Kickstarter multiplies the issue of communicating your game to an audience. So we know already that if you're making an indie game, one of the most important things about it is the core concept, whether it's doing something new, whether it's doing something that people have an affinity for already. If you have that concept there, your communication becomes easier, but then you still have to put the work in to clearly communicate that through video, through the things you're writing about it, through the way that you approach your Kickstarter page and so on. Because you don't have a game that's out that other people can play and defend you when people criticize you, you have a huge problem because you have to communicate everything in advance of there being any evidence for it. So not only that, you have to make people believe you, you have to make people believe you're competent enough to execute the thing and that the thing is plausible. Maybe you're making a super crazy ambitious game and you know that you can do it, but there's no reason for anyone else to believe that. That might not be a good candidate for Kickstarter. So Yeah,
I was looking at the Obsidian Kickstarter that started early this week. They're making sort of a spiritual sequel to Planescape. And I was actually thinking that I much more support Kickstarters for AAA games than for high-rent indie games. I really like Kickstarter as a concept for things which you genuinely can't afford to do otherwise. And I think that's true for a lot of hardware-based stuff, stuff that requires production and research. And it's also true for AAA games. I really, when you compare Kickstarter to the traditional publisher model for a really big studio like Obsidian, I just think it's fabulous. And I can see, being as a consumer, how I would really, really go for that. I think you get into a lot of gray areas with this stuff, which is, you know, guys who used to be in the games industry who maybe have some IP or some very vague name recognition getting into Kickstarter because it's sort of a little bit feels like free lunch right now. It's a lot of really gray areas there for me, but like for just AAA stuff from a really good studio, that means they don't have to go with a like pitch to a publisher and do all the things that publisher needs to see. I really like that.
Well, it's exactly the reason that those studios existed. It is to kind of promote themselves as a unit to make a game. So they already have all those skills to do that. They can do it to the general public. I think the Kickstarter audience does like the idea of the, supporting the underdog, though. So that's where you get some of these indie projects coming in.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I still don't feel like I understand the Kickstarter audience very much. People have lots of very different strong feelings about it. And it's still this question of a lot of people give money based on things they want to have made, and a lot of people give money based on people that they like, and almost giving extra money to a studio who made a game that they really liked before. And the thing about those two groups is those are two really, really, really different groups of people, and they have completely different agendas, and it's quite hard to communicate properly with both of them at the same time.
Absolutely. I still think the Kickstarter audience, the one thing I can say about it with authority is that it's very emotional, that it's making decisions about nostalgia, about future promises, and because you're not buying something that exists. It's not about getting the product, it's about paying for a feeling. So I think that, you know, factors into both of those groups.
Yeah, definitely. And again, like, is it paying for the feeling of having control over the game industry and control over what gets made, or is it paying for the feeling of feeling more associated with people that you really like and products that you really like? Those two things I feel are different. And again, like, that core difficulty of interplay, like, you know, I have some really, really favorite games, and if they ask for money in certain ways, then I'm really happy to do it. And then there are some people who are doing it too cynically for me. So yeah.
On to something else now. Slashdot brings news of a 1,800 simultaneous player Just Cause 2 mod. Ian Hardingham, should the mainstream industry be embarrassed by this modding effort?
No, they shouldn't be. The Slashdot article implied that an 1,800 person on a server Just Cause 2 mod somehow showed that modders were better at this kind of thing than game studios, and that can often be true, but that doesn't mean anyone should be embarrassed. I think there's an interesting concept here. I think as tools and middleware and knowledge and professionalism of sort of small groups of people and individual people get better, you'll start to see quite a lot of things like this be done by individuals when previously they could only be done by big companies. And I think MMOs is probably a good example of this. I think in the next 5 years, we'll start seeing some tools which enable anyone to make really effective MMOs. And it's kind of, this is just an example of how making a game is so complicated and requires such a lot of work. There are some areas that almost never get enough attention, and it requires the modding teams to give them that much of attention. So I'm kind of excited to see where we go with this next stage of possibly indie MMOs.
Do you think that's going to lead to some different forms of design if this kind of technology is being democratized?
Yeah, definitely. You know, people will be making a load of crazy things, 95% of which don't work and 5% do. And then maybe in 15 years, the actual next World of Warcraft will be based on one of those things. I mean, Minecraft's probably the closest example, but maybe something more purely multiplayer and more massively multiplayer than that.
This kind of thing, I mean, I've never played any sort of super large scale things apart from MMO, like I've never played Battlefield. I just think it must be pretty difficult if you have that number of players running around to do anything meaningful with them, especially in a kind of competitive game.
Well, Battlefield's only generally sort of, you know, 64, 128 at the high side, but, you know, maybe something like Planet Side.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I mean to play Planet Side. People say it works really well. I mean, I guess it just gets split up into smaller sort of parts of the battlefield, so you find meaning in little skirmishes.
Yeah.
But again, that may be because no one's come up with a way of making all those people relevant. You know, it seems to be like there should be a middle ground between that democratized Pong game where everyone decided to go left or right and, you know, and World of Warcraft. There seems like there should be some middle ground there.
Yeah. Changing tack again now. To the financial world, PayPal have apparently stopped users making domestic payments within Argentina, citing the fact that locals are using it to get around governmental restrictions on the purchase of US dollars. Ian Hardingham, what are we to make of this?
Well, so I wanted to talk about this because this just seems so amazing. So some people in Argentina found out how to use PayPal to buy dollars cheaper than they could do under normal circumstances and basically sort of make money using PayPal's better exchange rates than they could get elsewhere. And then the idea that the entire of the country would have just PayPal, which is still a massive means of commerce, blocked from them, from using them, you know, so they can buy things via PayPal from a different country, but they can't buy an Argentinian product using PayPal. It just seems so amazing that these companies have so much power that an entire country can have a serious part of its commerce just removed because of that.
You know what this is? This is a classic PayPal solution. PayPal is the company that brings a tank to a bar fight. It's the company that opens a can with a drill. They just don't understand proportion. They would rather destroy the entire world than have one thing go wrong on their birthday. They're just, it's impossible to comprehend where this kind of, maybe it's just because they're such an unregulated financial company and they're so terrified of doing something wrong that some financial authority is finally going to shut them down.
Yeah, we are not fans of PayPal at this podcast. I would be very amused by Argentina declaring war on PayPal and maybe actually invading their headquarters. That would be great.
I would love that.
But yeah, maybe it's PayPal's fault sort of in general. But you know, you're going to start seeing these things as commerce on the internet becomes so unbelievably easy and governments lose control over it.
Yeah.
There probably will be sort of an actually sort of really, really difficult period where some governments try to stop online commerce that aren't going through their own approved systems. And that could be an interesting time.
Yeah, the economies are so based around national identity still that you're absolutely right. This kind of threatening of that genuinely now with things really changing, especially in the current situation, it's going to be difficult for governments to know how to react to it. So maybe that, you know, justifies this defensive attitude that PayPal have.
Yeah, it's difficult to get a feeling from my point of view of how like big PayPal is. You know, it's sort of seems a little bit small when you think about it, but then it's probably as big as quite a large bank. I remember my dad about 7 years ago complaining that he wasn't going to use PayPal because it sounded like a mom and pop operation.
Right.
And I still think it has some issues with that because I don't know if people understand quite what to do with PayPal as a concept, and they keep acting like this. You know, they keep acting like a major bank, but without any of the communication.
Well, that's absolutely it. Nobody knows what PayPal is. Nobody knows what status they have, and nobody knows how to regulate them. So until one of those things gets solved, this kind of thing is only going to continue.
Yeah.
Eurogamer are reporting that there are 8 different Halo 4 UK pre-order deals. Ian Hardingham, is that too many different Halo 4 pre-order deals?
I think that might be too many. I feel like we should revisit this slightly boring topic of of retailer-specific pre-order bonuses.
I'm going to look at these while you
there
talk.
There are some pretty funny ones here. So a lot of them are in-game skins, etc. But there are stuff like a T-shirt and some kind of weird like emblem and physical item, etc. And, you know, I think Shop2, Play.com, Blockbuster, Amazon, Tesco, HMV, Game, and Granger Games. Those are the 8 people who have several different things. I just think it's weird.
I just don't know what to do with this. Like, why do they... So I'm a Halo fan. Like, the only people who are going to be buying this are mega fans, right? So they're looking at this list going, maybe I want my Spartan avatar. Maybe I want my Assassin emblem. Oh, I have to... Go to
they're the only ones who will actually care about where they get it from. You know, I mean, I think normal consumers going to any of these locations just get it, you know, for free. I don't think you have to. But I suppose you're right. If it's pre-orders, then it will be major fans and sort of moderate fans. Yeah, I mean, do you really make... I don't even know where my Granger Games is. Granger Games are from the north, I think.
They
so
are,
I'm not
yeah.
sure.
Is this just sure. Is this just to placate each retailer? Like, to say, oh, you have this exclusive thing? It must be, because it makes no sense.
Yeah, I think Games started sort of almost requiring it, and then everyone else said, hey, give us something as well. And of course, it can't be the same thing, otherwise it wouldn't be exclusive. So, you know, so some poor like low-rent artist at their company has had to spend the last 2 months making special Xbox Live Spartan Warrior avatar.
Yeah.
And the Deadeye helmet. I pour scorn on this console-ness, I honestly do.
Do you know, I'm sorry for the guy who has to have all of those things, who goes round, because there's going to be a guy, maybe 3, who go round and they have to have
it 8 times, and then in a year you'll find that they're all normal DLC, because you know that there's a statute of limitations on this exclusivity.
GamesIndustry.biz have a piece about the enormous growth of Bethesda and how they are focusing on big games. Do you see this focus as an intelligent reaction to the current gaming marketplace?
Yeah, I read this article. I don't know. I mean, I love Bethesda. I love that they're making Dishonored and obviously all of their all of the Elder Scrolls stuff. That they're worried about Elder Scrolls Online, which is good because I think they should be worried about Elder Scrolls Online and possibly not do it. They're a great company and they own ID. I don't know what to say. I mean, they say that that all these great studios they have some cross-pollination. Mm. And everyone's sort of inspired a little bit, like, by the almost ultimate freedom of Skyrim and sort of go a little bit in that direction.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, you know, Bethesda is great.
I think this just indicates what people have been saying about the big end of the industry getting bigger. So just as we've been talking about how it's difficult to make these single-player games free-to-play, what the response to that actually is to just make them big, like, to try and increase the scope that you get for your pay-once game, to try and make it more of a graphically exciting experience. And that's kind of interesting, that everyone's now trying to get around this AAA thing, but instead you've got Bethesda there just acquiring people, building this giant monolithic thing.
Yeah, I suppose so. I haven't been paying much attention to it. I'm excited for some AAA games that are coming out soon. I'm really excited for Borderlands 2 and for aforementioned Dishonored. So yep. I'm really pleased that some guys are still doing interesting, really expensive stuff, but I don't know where it's going to go next. Like, it seems like we're in a period of transition now, and the console, the next generation console, no one's really sure what to do. We're probably just in a bit of a holding pattern until someone, you know, makes a big move.
I'm just wondering, like, maybe this isn't the time of indie games, maybe it's the time of mega AAA games. Maybe that's what's going to define the industry more.
Well, we've always said that indie games took over the AA
and
the single A, you know, and haven't had anything to do with the AAA. So I agree with that, but I think people will always remember starting in 2009, I think, as the sort of the real golden age of indies. I definitely don't think that's ended yet.
And finally today, according to VG247, Microsoft have patented wearable controller tech powered by muscles. What do you think is next for body-controlled gaming?
Well, I think this is the kind of thing that I talk about a lot when I poo-poo 3D and stuff and sort of motion control to a certain extent. I just think that people like a 2D screen that they can have in their living room in the context of their lives that isn't really, really intrusive. And I think the same is true for controlling things. Our hands are the things that are best at controlling things. And that's just the way it is. So I think this stuff is always going to be a bit of a circus sideshow. Mm. I'm so annoyed at Microsoft patenting all sorts of random crap, you know. And I wish Valve their best with their wearable computing tech as well. I mean, Kinect, I think Kinect needs to get better. They either need to decide that Kinect is unworkable, which I don't think it is, or it needs to get a lot better. That's probably where I think it's going next.
I mean, I believe there was some stuff in the leaked next gen console document, whether that was, I don't know if that was proved or disproved to be real, but that about improving Kinect significantly, which I think is probably the right direction. I'm just, Kinect is the thing that leaves behind this idea of like muscle body control. Like, because you don't need these things on your body if Kinect works. Do you think that technology will get good enough that that will happen, that you won't need to put things on your joints?
I'm not sure it matters. Yeah, yes, I do think that in the end, with maybe a couple more cameras, like you might need a camera somewhere else in the room, maybe. But, you know, I think there's no particular reason why that shouldn't be able to do perfect body mapping when we get to that level of processing.
It's the end of wearable computing update, and now into the sordid antechamber of the show, where we talk about various things. Now, the game that I want to try most at the moment, because everyone is talking about it, even though I think I'm going to hate it, is FTL. The reason I think I'm going to hate it is because it just looks so complicated, and it looks very hard, and complicated and hard are things that tend to put me off. Are you going to try this game? Have you tried this game?
I haven't yet. I've seen Robin playing it.
Yep.
It doesn't look like my kind of game, but I'm definitely going to. I'm going to wait for like a weekend when my wife's away or something, and then I might like. Because I feel like I need a lot of energy to play it. Like, I feel like I really need to have a lot of mental focus.
Yeah. Maybe we should play it together and live stream it for the show. That would be a total disaster. Maybe we should do that. We should do that more. Yeah, and Borderlands 2, of course, which I believe you've purchased, but you have not yet played. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's not activated yet.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I preloaded it on Steam.
Right. Well, there you go. Well, that's
and
the...
I think I'm going to be able to get Little Big Planet 2 tonight. I think that actually releases on the PlayStation Store tonight. Mm.
It's a big time for new games. Now, just before we wrap the show up, I'm going to ask the chat if they have any questions. So please spam your questions away merrily in the chat, and we'll try and get to them after the segment is completed. Now, sir, is there anything that you would like to discuss in the world of sports, movies, current affairs?
I watched Lawless.
Oh, yeah?
Which a lot of people are giving 4 stars. I didn't think it was quite tight enough for 4 stars, but it is very good. It definitely would be on the upper end of 3 stars.
Okay.
It's probably worth watching. It's kind of hyper-violent, but totally, probably not hyper-violent, sort of whatever's between very violent and hyper-violent. It's kind of got the same sort of tone as a bit of Post-Sopranos, a bit of Boardwalk Empire, that kind of thing. It's got some good acting. It's a little bit simplistic. It's probably worth watching at the cinema, I'd say. I enjoyed it.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, no, I kind of... It looked a bit sort of dark and a bit kind of po-faced. Would you say that's a fair criticism?
I don't know. It's probably slightly too like it's got real heroes in it. Like, I don't know if it's too dark. Like, it's a little bit seedy and slimy, but it's kind of I wouldn't quite call it dark. And po-faced, I don't know actually about that. Maybe like Guy Pearce is going through a bit of a resurgence right now. Oddly.
Yeah, he is, and definitely.
He's really good in it, so that's good. I think he's one of those people who tried to be an action star and didn't quite make that. But it's really good at being like, you know, like instead of being a starting pitcher, he's really good as a reliever. Like, he's really good as a character role.
Fantastic. All right, we have a single question from the chat from Weevil92, who says, when will there be news on your new game? And to this, I would say probably in a couple of months' time. I don't think that's an unrealistic time frame for that. We have to see how a few things go, and we have to get it ready to show to all of the hungry, angry people on the internet who want to devour it and destroy it from every angle. But I'd say a couple of months.
So, yeah, I've now been working on it for over a year. It's in full production now. So when you see something, you will see quite a lot, is what I can say. Like, you're not going to see a couple of pieces of concept art and a paragraph. Like, you'll see something real.
And before the next inevitable question, which is when is the iPad version coming out, arrives, I shall say that we are still working on it. We have a very trusted and noble member of our extended force who is currently working on some bugs, and I have to go and talk with him about that.
Deputy
soon.
Sheriff Mango Fusion.
He's here. He's in the chat. He does a winky smiley to indicate his presence. There we go. Thanks very much for tuning in, everyone. We will see you again at the same time next week, 6 p.m. UK time, twitch.tv/mode7games. Go to visitingthevillage.com and please add us on Facebook and all of that good stuff so you know when it's happening. Ian Hardingham, you should now say goodbye.
Thank you and goodbye.
That's it, children. Time for bed. Don't forget to pay us a visit at www.visitingthevillage.com.